Chapter 6, Night of the Gramicites. Gramicite. Generic term for a parasitic life form that lives inside books and feeds on grama. Technically known as gerunds or ingers, they were an early attempt to transform nouns, which were plentiful, into verbs, which at the time were not, by simply attaching an ing. A dismal failure at verb resource management, they escaped from captivity and now roam freely in the sub-basements. Although they are thankfully quite rare in the library itself, isolated pockets of gramicites are still found from time to time and dealt with mercilessly. Cat, formerly known as Cheshire, Guide to the Great Library. I turned and walked quickly towards the elevators, a strong feeling of impending oddness raising the hair on the back of my neck. I pressed the call button, but nothing happened. I quickly dashed across the corridor and tried the second bank of elevators, but with no more success. I was just thinking of running to the stairwell when I heard a noise. It was a distant, low moan that was quite unlike any other sort of low moan that I had ever heard, nor would ever want to hear again. I put down the head in a bag as my palms grew sweaty, and although I told myself I was calm, I pressed the call button several more times and reached for my automatic as a shape hove into view from the depths of the corridor. It was flying close to the bookshelves and was something like a bat, something like a lizard and something like a vulture. It was covered in patchy grey fur and wearing stripy socks and a brightly coloured waistcoat of questionable taste. I had seen this sort of thing before. It was a gramicite. And although dissimilar to the ejectivore I had seen in Great Expectations, I imagined it could do just as much harm. It was little wonder that the residents of the well had locked themselves away. The gramicite swept past in a flash without noticing me and was soon gone with a rumble like distant artillery. I relaxed slightly, expecting to see the well spring back into life, but nothing stirred. Far away in the distance, beyond the slaughtered lamb, an excited burble reached my straining ears. I pressed the call button again as the noise grew louder and a slight breeze drafted against my face, like the oily zephyr that precedes an underground train. I shuddered. Where I came from, a Browning automatic spoke volumes, but how it would work on a grammar-sucking parasite I had no idea, and I didn't think this would be a good time to find out. I was preparing myself to run when there was a melodious bing. The call button light came on and one of the elevator pointers started to move slowly towards my floor. I ran across and leaned with my back against the doors, releasing the safety on my automatic as the wind and noise increased. By the time the elevator was four floors away, the first gramicites had arrived. They looked around the corridor as they flew, sniffing at books with their long snouts and giving off excited squeaks. This was the advance guard. A few seconds later, the main flock arrived with a deafening roar. One or two of them poked at books until they fell off the shelves, while other gramicites fell upon the unfinished manuscripts with an excited cry. There was a scuffle as a character burst from a page, only to be impaled by a gramicite, who reduced the unfortunate wretch to a few explanatory phrases, which were then eaten by scavengers waiting on the sidelines. I had seen enough. I opened fire and got three of them straight away, who were devoured in turn by the same scavengers. Clearly there was little honour or sense of loss amongst gramicites. Their compatriots merely shuffled into the gaps left by their fallen comrades. I picked off two who were scrabbling at the bookcases, attempting to dislodge more books, and then turned away to reload. As I did, another eerie silence filled the corridor. I released the slide on my automatic and looked up. About 100 or so gramicites were staring at me with their small black eyes, and it wasn't a look that I'd describe as anywhere near friendly. I sighed. What a way to go. I could see my headstone now. Thursday next, 1950 to 1986, Spec Ops agent and beloved wife to someone who doesn't exist, died for no adequately explained reason in an abstract place by an abstract foe. I raised my gun, and the gramicite shuffled slightly, as though deciding amongst themselves who would be sacrificed for them to overpower me. I pointed the gun at whichever one started to move, hoping to postpone the inevitable. The one who seemed to be the leader, he had the brightest coloured waistcoat I noted, took a step forward and I pointed my gun at him as another gramicite seized the opportunity and made a sudden leap towards me. its sharpened beak heading straight for my chest. I whirled around in time to see its small black eyes twinkle with a thousand well-digested verbs when a hand on my shoulder pulled me roughly backwards into the elevator. The Gramacite carried on by its own momentum, buried its beak into the wood surround. I reached to thump the close button, but my wrist was deftly caught by my as-yet unseen saviour. "We never run from Gramacites!" It was a scolding tone of voice that I knew only too well. Miss Havisham, dressed in her rotting wedding dress and veil, she stared at me with despair. I think I was one of the worst apprentices she had ever trained. Or that was the way she made me feel, at any rate. "We have nothing to fear except fear itself," she intoned, whipping out her pocket derringer and dispatching two Gramacites who made a rush at the elevator's open door. "I seem to spend my waking hours extricating you from the soup, my girl." The Gramacites were slowly advancing on us. They were now at least 300 strong, and others were joining them. We were heavily outnumbered. "I'm sorry," I replied quickly, curtsying just in case as I loosed off another shot. "But don't you think we should be departing?" "I fear only the questing beast," announced Havisham imperiously. "The questing beast, Big Martin and Semolina." She shot another Gramacite with a particularly fruity waistcoat and carried on talking. "If you had trouble to do some homework, you would know that these are verbisoids and probably the easiest Gramacite to vanquish of them all." And almost without pausing for breath, Miss Havisham launched into a croaky and out-of-tune rendition of William Blake's Jerusalem. The Gramacites stopped abruptly and stared at one another. By the time I had joined her at the Holy Lamb of God line, they had begun to back away in fright. We sang louder, Miss Havisham and I, and by dark satanic mills they had started to take flight. By the time we had got to Bring Me My Chariot of Fire, they had departed completely. "Quick," said Miss Havisham, "grab the waistcoats. There's a bounty on each one." We stripped the waistcoats from the fallen Gramacites. It was not a pleasant job. The corpses smelt so strongly of ink that it made me cough. The carcasses would be taken away by a verminator, who would boil down the bodies and distill off any verbs he could. In the well, nothing is wasted. "What were the smaller ones?" "I forget," replied Havisham, gathering up the waistcoats. "Here, you're going to need this. Study it well if you want to pass your exams." She handed me my travel book, the one that Goliath had taken. Within its pages were almost all the tips and equipment I needed for travel within the book world. "How did you manage that?" Miss Havisham didn't answer. She was a bit like a strict parent, your worst teacher and a newly appointed South American dictator all rolled into one. Which wasn't to say I didn't like her or respect her. It was just that I felt I was still 9 whenever she spoke to me. "Why do Gramacites wear stripy socks?" I ventured, tying up the waistcoats with some string that Havisham had given me. "Probably because spotted ones are out of fashion," she replied with a shrug, reloading her pistol. "What's in the bag?" "Oh, some shopping of Snell's." I tried to change the subject. I didn't suppose carrying around unlicensed plot devices was something Havisham would approve of, even if they were Snell's. "So why did William sing Jerusalem to get rid of them?" "As I said, those Gramacites were verbisoids," she replied without looking up. "And a verbisoid, in common with many language students, hates and fears irregular verbs. They far prefer consuming regular verbs with the ED word ending. Strong irregulars, such as to sing with their internal vowel changes. We will sing, we sang, we have sung, tend to scramble their tiny minds." "Any irregular verb frightens them off?" I asked with interest. "Pretty much, but some irregulars are more easy to demonstrate than others. We could cut, I suppose, or even be, but then the proceedings change into something akin to a desperate game of charades. Far easier to just sing and have done with it." "What about if we were to go?" I ventured, thinking practically for once. "There can't be anything more irregular than go, went, gone, can there?" "Because," replied Miss Havisham, her patience eroding by the second, "they might misconstrue it as walked. Note the ED ending." "Not if we ran," I added, not wanting to let this go. "That's irregular too." Miss Havisham stared at me icily. Of course we could. But ran might be seen in the eyes of a hungry verbosoid to be either trotted, galloped, raced, rushed, hurried, hastened, sprinted, or even departed. Ah, I said, realizing that trying to catch Miss Havisham out was about as likely as nailing Banquo's ghost to a coffee table. Yes, it might, mightn't it? Look, said Miss Havisham, softening slightly. If running away killed Gramercites, there wouldn't be a single one left. Stick to Jerusalem and you won't go far wrong. Just don't try it with the objectivores or the parataxes. They'd probably join in and then eat you. She snorted, picked up the bundle of waistcoats, and pulled me towards the elevator, which had just reopened. It was clear that the 22nd sub-basement wasn't a place she liked to be. I couldn't say I blamed her. She relaxed visibly as we rose from the sub-basements and into the more ordered nature of the library itself. We weren't alone in the elevator. With us was a large painted jaguar and her son, who had a paddy paw full of prickles and was complaining bitterly that he had been tricked by a hedgehog and a tortoise, who had both escaped. The mother jaguar shook her head sadly and looked at us both with an exasperated air before addressing her son. "Son, son," she said, ever so many times, graciously waving her tail. "What have you been doing that you shouldn't have?" "So," said Miss Havisham as the elevator moved off, "how are you getting along in that frightful Caversham Heights book?" "Well, thank you, Miss Havisham," I muttered. "The characters in it are worried that their book will be demolished from under their feet." "With good reason, I expect. Hundreds of books like Heights are demolished every day. If you stop to waste any sympathy, you'd go nuts, so don't. It's man eat man in the well. I'd keep yourself to yourself and don't make too many friends. They have a habit of dying just when you get to like them. It always happens that way. It's a narrative thing." "Heights isn't a bad place to live," I ventured, hoping to elicit a bit of compassion. "Doubtless," she murmured, staring at the floor indicator. "I remember when I was in the well, when they were building Great Expectations. I thought I was the luckiest girl in the world when they told me I would be working with Charles Dickens, top of my class at generic college, and, without seeming immodest, something of a beauty. I thought I would make an admirable young Estella, both refined and beautiful, haughty and proud, yet ultimately overcoming the overbearing crabbiness of her cantankerous benefactor to find true love. So, what happened? I wasn't tall enough." "Tall enough? For a book? Isn't that like having the wrong hair colour for the wireless? They gave the part to a little strumpet who was on salvage from a demolished Thackeray. Little cow! It's no wonder I treat her so rotten. The part should have been mine." She fell into silence. "Let me get this straight," said the painted jaguar, who was having a bit of trouble telling the difference between a hedgehog and a tortoise. "If it's slow and solid, I drop him in the water and then scoop him out of his shell." "Son, son," said his mother ever so many times, graciously waving her tail. "Now attend to me and remember what I say. A hedgehog curls himself up into a ball and his prickles stick out every way." "Did you get the jurisfiction exam papers I sent you?" asked Miss Havisham. "I've got your practical booked for the day after tomorrow." "Oh," I said with quite the wrong tone in my voice. "Problems?" she asked, eyeing me suspiciously. "No, Mum, I just feel a bit unprepared. I think I might make a pig's ear of it." "I disagree. I know you'll make a pig's ear of it, but wheels within wheels. All I ask is you don't make a fool of yourself or lose your life. Now that would be awkward." "So," said the painted jaguar, rubbing his head, "if it can roll itself into a ball, it must be a tortoise and—" "Ah," cried the mother jaguar, lashing her tail angrily, "completely wrong. Miss Havisham, what am I to do with this boy?" "I have no idea," she replied. "All men are dolts from where I'm standing." The painted jaguar looked crestfallen and stared at the floor. "Can I make a suggestion?" I asked. "Anything," replied the mother jaguar. "If you make a rhyme out of it, he might be able to remember." The mother jaguar sighed.
It won't help. Yesterday he forgot he was a painted jaguar. He makes my spots ache. Really, he does.
How about this? I said, making up a rhyme on the spot. Can't curl, but can swim. Slow, solid, that's him. Curls up, but can't swim. Stickly, prickly, that's him. The mother jaguar stopped lashing her tail and asked me to write it down. She was still trying to get her son to remember it when the elevator doors opened on the fifth floor and we got out. I thought we were going to the jurisdiction offices, I said as we walked along the corridors of the great library, the wooden shelves groaning under the weight of the collected imaginative outpourings of nearly 2 millennia.
The next roll call is tomorrow, Miss Havisham replied,
stopping at a shelf and dropping the Grammarite's waistcoats into a heap before picking out a roughly bound manuscript.
And I told Perkins you'd help him feed the Minotaur.
You did? I asked slightly apprehensively.
Of course. Fictional zoology is a fascinating subject, and believe me, it's an area in which you should know more.
She handed me the book, which, I noticed, was handwritten.
It's code word protected, announced Havisham. Mumble sapphire before you read yourself in.
She gathered up the waistcoats again.
I'll pick you up in about an hour. Perkins will be waiting for you on the other side. Please pay attention and don't let him talk you into looking after any rabbits. Don't forget the password. You'll not get in or out without it.
Sapphire, I repeated.
Very good, she said,
and vanished. I placed the book on one of the reading desks and sat down. The marble busts of writers that dotted the library seemed to glare at me, and I was just about to start reading when I noticed, high up on the shelf opposite, an ethereal form that was coalescing, wraith-like, in front of my eyes. At home this might be considered a matter of great pith and moment, but here it was merely the Cheshire Cat making one of his celebrated appearances.
"Hello,"
he said as soon as his mouth had appeared.
"How are you getting along?"
The Cheshire Cat was the librarian, and the first person I had met in the book world. With a penchant for non-sequiturs and obtuse comments, it was hard not to like him.
"I'm not sure," I replied.
"I was attacked by Grammarites, threatened by Big Martin's friends, and a thrall. I've got 2 generics billeted with me. The characters in Caversham Heights think I can save their book, and right now I have to give the Minotaur his breakfast."
"Nothing remarkable there. Anything else?"
"How long have you got?"
"Vera Tushkevich, can you hear me?" "Yes, I'm here. No need to shout. You will deafen me, I'm sure." "I don't trust these strange footnotophone devices. I'm sure I'll catch some nasty proletarian disease. Where did we last meet?" "At the party with the Schutzbergs. The one where they served apples benedict." "No, Sophia. My husband and I were not invited. He voted against Count Schutzberg at the last election."
"Then it must have been at Bolshaya Maxaya with Princess Betsy's. Whatever did happen to that Karenin girl? Have you any idea?"
"Anna?" "Yes, indeed. But you must not tell a soul. Alexei Vronsky was smitten by her from the moment he saw her at the station."
"The station? Which station?"
"St. Petersburg. You remember when a guard fell beneath the train and was crushed?"
"Anna and Vronsky met there. How terribly unsophisticated."
"There is more, my dear Sophia." "Wait, the doorbell. I must leave you, not a word to anyone, and I will call again soon."
I tapped my ears.
"Problems?"
"I can hear 2 Russians gossiping right here inside my head."
"Probably a crossed footnotophone line," replied the cat.
He jumped down, pressed his head against mine, and listened intently.
"Can you hear them?"
I asked after a bit.
"Not at all," replied the cat. "But you do have very warm ears. Do you like Chinese food?"
"Yes, please." I hadn't eaten for a while.
"Me too," mused the cat. "Shame there isn't any. What's in the bag?"
"Something of Snell's."
"Ah, what do you think of this ultra-word lark?"
"I'm not really sure," I replied truthfully enough. "How about you?"
How about me what?
What do you think of the new operating system?
When it comes in, I shall give it my fullest attention, he said ambiguously, adding, It's a laugh, isn't it?
What is?
That noise you make at the back of your throat when you hear something funny. Let me know if you need anything. Bye!
And he slowly faded out from the tip of his tail to the tip of his nose. His grin, as usual, stayed for some time after the rest of him had gone. I turned back to the book, murmured, Sapphire, and read the first paragraph aloud.